You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.
All right, boss, ready when you are.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of the Toiled of Hell radio show. I'm Joe Thrash and Kill. With me, I've got two nice fellas. First up, we've got 365 Days of Horror, also known as Jordan. Jordan, how are you?
I am once again ceding my time for introduction hellos to now wish you, Joe, a happy birthday.
You are too sweet. And hey, we on the show as well, we got our good buddy, Brinicide. Bruno, how are you?
Well, you know, I would be good, but as a nice fella, as a really nice guy, I just see all these women that would prefer to be with abusers instead of me. So that kind of sticks in my craw a bit. But happy birthday, sir. Are you still a part of this very fiery, important Leo season we're having?
No, I'm a keep your jokes to yourselves, nerds. I'm a Virgo.
Virgo Joe.
Yeah, that's what they call me. No, it's cool. Right now I'm at the same age that Jesus was when he died. So I guess I'm fully like an adult and ready to be sacrificed as a child of God. So that's tight.
Yeah, man. Look what he accomplished instead of you in all that short time.
Yeah. He fucked up the year order. I don't know what year it's supposed to be, because there was that section of 33 years between BC and AD, and I don't know where that time went or how we're going to count those years, but the point is, it is no longer 2020, and we need to stop pretending it is. I feel really strongly about this, as you can tell.
Yeah, it's. I mean, we should just keep counting from, like, year one. Like, from whatever... Whatever BC was, like, let's just count backwards. Let's figure it out and just be like, okay, that was year one. Let's just count up from there. We call this whatever numbers of billions that it is.
Yeah, I figure we start year one is like the first when humans first learned to count up to at least one.
Yeah,
that would make the most sense.
Perfect.
We got a show for you, folks. We got a number of things to discuss. I found some ancient things from the memory hole that we're going to get into. But first of all, I would like to relay a story that relates to last week's episode. I went to the grocery store last night, and I saw a woman wearing a Sturgis Bike Rally 2020 shirt, and I wanted to commit a hate crime, going to be honest with you.
Hell yeah, brother.
is it a hate crime? Are bikers a protected group?
Yeah, I think they're a protected group. That's what I hear.
Yeah.
Bike lives matter.
Yeah. It's just, you know, you're advertising to me in this public space that you went and got yourself the goddamn plague, and now you are immersed in the middle of hundreds of people that didn't go fucking suck each other in the middle of a pandemic to intentionally spread the plague. And I don't know. I feel like we should shun these people, cast them out of polite society. I'm not sure. I could just be a little harsh because it's early in the morning right now.
I mean, COVID's going to shun some of them permanently.
COVID ain't going away. Oh. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I know that maybe it's a little medieval to create a leper colony of some kind, but I think a biker colony would be right up their alley. They'd be real into it.
I mean, as long as you supply like enough Michelob Ultra and at least a couple of bands that can do a passable cover of Born to Be Wild, I think we'll be set.
Just ship like a dinghy over there, just full of Marlboro Reds, and that's it. You're good.
Yeah, I think it would work. It would work for everybody. This solution to separate from society the bikers and let them enjoy each other's company. I think that it's a win-win for all of us.
Perfect. We'll airdrop some wintergreen flavored skull and turkey jerky and they'll be fine.
You gotta pack both sides of your lip.
Take me to flavor country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were seeing, Jordan, you were seeing that the vector of infection has spread.
who could have predicted this? But yes, all these people gathering together and breathing their hot, stinky AC/DC lyric breath all over each other. They now have confirmed coronavirus cases directly linked to people with attendant surges in Minnesota, South Dakota, and Nebraska.
I mean, we're just getting started. It only ended a few, like, 7 days ago.
There was a story. It's actually on the Daily Beast of all places. Half the story was about a Motley Crue cover band that played one of the venues. And it was, I mean, it's just an exercise in sadness reading about a Motley Crue cover band, about how they had to, like, play little shows in their area to raise, like, $3,000 to rent a van and to get a hotel to play Sturgis.
Jesus Christ. And because when we went through the lineup of the official concert series in Sturgis, we mentioned it, but none of the cover bands are being listed there, of course.
Yeah, that's if for people who don't know, Sturgis isn't just like one or two venues or a couple bars. It's many, many bars that are up and down their main street and on side streets, and only the bands we covered were the bands that people have heard about. This was at like One-Eyed Jerk-Off Saloon, something like that, and it was just one of those places where no one had masks, and eventually they shut the venue down because someone who had been there for about 5 hours as a patron later tested positive for coronavirus, and this band, this Motley Crue cover band that played, didn't get paid by the venue for whatever reason. And they chalked it up to karma of they didn't get paid, so now people have coronavirus that work and went to that bar.
Jesus fucking Christ.
So everything about that story is sad.
Yeah, that is pretty pretty pathetic. This is choice listening. Go back and listen to our episode about the tribute documentary, please.
Yeah, all I want to know is if the lead singer of the Motley Crue cover band is actually as fat or fatter than the actual Motley Crue singer.
I read this thing. The guy mentioned being in his late 40s, I believe, so probably not quite, but getting there.
Yeah, got that Michelob not-so-ultra gut.
Punch, punch, punch.
Yeah, man. It's probably best if they don't think about their own role in doing this. Just yeah. Also, I want to go ahead and clarify that the name of the bar that they played at was One-Eyed Jack's, right?
Yeah.
So basically, the same name of the casino / speakeasy / underage prostitution ring in Twin Peaks.
Probably named after a different name. Yeah.
Probably, I would pick anything else.
Yeah, probably like an honoring of the Twin Peaks bar.
I would go with like Cirrhosis O'Hannity's. Anything is better than that.
What I was saying before we started recording was that aside from the unfortunate death of Frankie Banali, the drummer from Quiet Riot, right? Pretty much news in terms of like metal news or music news has just been like a big white blank space that they've just been trying to fill with nonsense on any given aggregation site here. So
I would like to clarify the connection though. Quiet Riot did play Sturgis.
Yeah.
So we're good. We're connecting all the dots, man. It doesn't matter that everybody's tired and hungover. We're doing the damn thing.
Yeah. Are we being told to mind our own business in terms of his death? Is there like actually any news of what happened to him?
I think he's been sick for a really long time. Oh, okay. Like cancer.
So he probably didn't play that one.
Or he might have and was like, fuck it. What's the point of, avoiding the thing?
Yeah. That's
I don't know. I don't know if anyone can confirm if Frankie Banali had, went out with a bang at fucking Sturgis of all places. Imagine if that was the punctuation of your career.
Yeah. Go ahead and email us and we'll go ahead and edit this episode and put it up again to include that information.
Yeah, we definitely will do that.
So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. You were talking about the pathetic state of the blogosphere.
Well, there's really nothing to interrupt, is there? It's just how I'm stunned by the things they're like scratching for and publishing this news. You got this pastor believing that Joe Biden is using satanic campaign imagery in his, I don't know, I think it was in the Democratic National Convention, like somebody figured the out logo. A pastor. Yeah, if you turn a star sideways, guys, guess what? It's a pentagram. And then everybody, like, you know, sent messages of, I'm sorry, sent pictures of the American flag to him. I was like, oh my God, look at all the Satans.
It's a flashback to Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, where they have the woman talking about how the devil horns, there's a secret 666 in there. It's like these people just want to see whatever they want to see so they can push their own misbegotten and misguided agenda. It's the same with like the Monster energy drink thing that people were talking about a year or two ago, how that had satanic connotations to it.
My wife, for my birthday, like 2 years ago, I think, she got me a t-shirt that has the FBI files for all the satanic symbols from the Satanic Panic, like Xerox on it. It's tight, man. Like, scorpions is included on there.
See, the hurricane is Satan.
Yes.
But also the winds of change is Satan.
Also Satan.
Yeah, the big city, that's hell.
It was a different time, but also it wasn't really.
No, everybody is, they've just replaced it with something stupider. It's just
the only thing that's changed is fashion and haircuts and technology.
I kind of went down a rabbit hole the other day, just thinking about the connections between the Satanic Panic of the 80s and the current insane fucking religious, semi-religious witch hunts with QAnon, and the parallels are kind of staggering in a way that I don't know. I wasn't really conscious of what was going on during the Satanic Panic, being too young to really be fully engrossed in it. Although I encountered a number of people in my religious upbringing that still were kind of diehard about a lot of this shit. You saw filtered down to like the Harry Potter panic and all that shit. Also, my mother did not approve of the band Kiss. I don't know if that was because of the satanic imagery or because Kiss fucking sucks.
But she was right for possibly the wrong reason.
Exactly. Yeah.
Knights in Satan's service.
But I don't think that any of these people ever went away, aside from maybe a few of them dying off. But instead of the religious fervor that surrounded the Satanic Panic with the quiet majority or what the moral majority that was going on at the time, I think people have mostly abandoned religion in favor of just some kind of morass of maloic worship that they believe Democrats are doing around celebrities and sex trafficking, and it kind of a little bit with the Pizzagate stuff too. I mean, this is just an acceleration of that before it.
I'm just amazed that they think that the constant horrible fuck ups of the Democrats are all just like some calculated scheme.
I mean, with every good conspiracy, there is a grain of truth to it, and that, you know, there are a lot of sex pests within the Democratic Party, but there are a lot of sex pests within the Republican Party. There are a lot of sex pests within metal. They're everywhere, dude. It's not a conspiracy as much as it is. There are a lot of really bad people in any kind of scene that you can gain a little bit of clout. You can try to take advantage of somebody.
Let's stop looking at the groups and start looking at bank accounts. It's like if it has a 7-figure or up, you know, that's where you're going to find all your sex pests.
More likely, yeah. Yeah.
That's really it. And that's the thing about conspiracy theories, like how true they are is based only off of how much money can be made based off their truth. Like there's no reason to lie about climate change because we could do a lot of poor things to the economy by tanking a lot of industries that hurt the climate. So obviously there's no conspiracy there. Why would we lie to you?
Yeah, no, if we could not go down that rabbit hole, I'd prefer not to spend the day.
Let's not fucking do it then. Apparently Atreyu parts ways with that guy Alex that sang for them, and that's it. Which is really funny because I thought Atreyu just parted ways with music altogether, so that's news for me.
I didn't know Atreyu was still around, so that is good to know. You know, it's tough to replace a singer and achieve the same level of success that you had before. but maybe they can.
He was the drummer slash clean vocalist. So they still have the guy who goes.
No. They have. Brandon was the drummer.
Oh, I apologize.
I was a child in 2004, so I know these people. Brandon.
So they got rid of the generic guy who makes the choking, hocking, spitting sound.
That guy.
However, will they recover?
He's. Well, I thought they parted ways with existence. I'm amazed that this is news, and it really goes to show you how hard the news is, because the two articles I found on it are two sentences long each.
Nobody gives a shit about Atreyu.
No one fucking cares.
I think part of it is because these websites and magazines and wherever are struggling for any content.
Yeah.
So when someone makes a comment on their social media, you got to jump on it because you need something to keep people coming back and keep making those advertising dollars.
I remember, I think it was in 2016. This is the last that I had heard of Atreyu. They put out a greatest hits record on double vinyl, and I thought it was really fucked up that somebody would just ship two blank discs.
Yeah, that's a good one. You got them. You burned them.
Atreyu, still a band. Tell me about more forgotten bands. Please.
Slipknot? I don't know.
They're probably around. The relationship that you were describing between the professional relationship you were describing between the members of Limp Bizkit,
that's
thought was
correct.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Let's get into that. So, Fred Durst recently came out about Limp Bizkit. I haven't seen a recent photograph of Fred Durst's head or face. I can't imagine it's something to look at.
He has a big white beard.
Yeah.
He's three quarters Santa Claus at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it. Recently he came out that he stated none of us were friends in terms of the other members of Limp Bizkit. Apparently he just met, the story goes, like, Wes Borland at a show, and he just started singing vocals with Wes Borland, and that was the magic, and that was it. There was nothing else there. And let's see if I can get some quotes here for you. Fred Durst says, "The first time I saw Wes Borland, he had ponytails and a girly half shirt on." That's cool. "He was playing in a band called Kronk and was like Les Claypool on guitar with a little Manson in there." Is Marilyn Manson known for his guitar playing? I don't. "I actually met Wes for the first time at our first gig. It was wild, but it worked. I made up vocals on the spot. We never took time to consider friendships. That wasn't part of it. It was just about the magic that happened when we were together. None of us were ever friends." And Durst continues on saying, in terms of the generation of jocks that had been created by his music, he says, "I always wanted my lyrics to be for people who felt maybe like I did, for victims. I should have made it more blatantly obvious, because some of our audience and our fans were not those people. They were the nemesis. They were the opposite. They were the people that I despised. And if I change anything, it would probably be to make things a little more clear about where I was coming from, trying to segregate the bullies from the victims. The irony of my life is on a stupendous level."
And where does Nookie fit in with all that?
Yeah.
Good question. Well, when you're feeling like a chump, Jordan, like a chump, hey,
yeah,
like a chump,
right?
You're a victim.
I see.
I would love to see video footage of this first Limp Bizkit show with Fred Durst freestyling off the dome with his 1995 rhymes. I think that would be incredible.
And just Wes Borland playing the only riffs he ever played in his career. Somewhere in there being a Les Claypool on guitar, which just did not translate whatsoever to the band he became most famous for.
Okay, that's interesting. I honestly thought that, like, some of the members of Limp Bizkit were, like, related.
Well, I don't know. It sounds like he's talking mostly about Wes Borland. I can't see anything else about all the other baby-faced chin beards that were in the band. They're probably all related. It's probably just like a family.
I mean, they look the same. They look the exact same.
Yeah.
To be fair, most white guys in the mid to late 90s all look like that.
That is true. So it was a little bit funny that that somehow came together to be like a platinum selling act. It seems unlikely to say the least, but hey, good for them. Don't think too much about what you wrought. Just think about the good times.
And it doesn't matter if a band is friends with each other or not. Like, to fans, it doesn't really make a difference. We're just enjoying the music ultimately, right?
Yeah, I don't think it would affect my enjoyment of any band if it was just like, oh, we all hated each other the entire time. Like, what was the deal you were telling me about Linkin Park?
So this wasn't like a Linkin Park hate each other thing. It's just that they were a creation from their record label. Previous to being Linkin Park, most of the members were a band called Zero, X-E-R-O. I'm pretty sure I discussed this on a previous podcast. But the label that they were on brought in Chester to do the clean vocals. I don't know if he was with another band at the time or they had signed him individually and were just kind of looking to puzzle piece him in with another band. And on top of that, because the label had, I believe it was a rapper who had a very similar name to Zero, like Zero the Hero or something like that, they said, nope, that's not going to be your name. Come up with another name. So they came up with Hybrid Theory as the band name. And the label said, nope, you're not going to be Hybrid Theory. That's a bad name. Choose out of like this list of names. And they became Linkin Park and named their album Hybrid Theory.
I think the label was right on that one. I think Hybrid Theory is a pretty shitty band name.
It's Linkin Park is more marketable, and it's almost like a Springfield and the Simpsons kind of effect where there are many Linkin Parks throughout the country, so people can kind of latch on to the I've already heard this, it is easily identifiable type thing. So
that makes sense.
So sometimes labels know what they're doing.
Plus it's spelt wrong, which is just, that's really
cool. That's cool.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
Good for searching on the internet.
It's cool to be stupid and uneducated.
I agree.
That's not how you spell biscuit, man. But
do you remember when we interviewed Liam Wilson from Dillinger Escape Plan?
Yeah, it was about
four years
ago now.
Yeah. He was saying, like, you know, people don't necessarily think of it that way, but Dillinger Escape Plan was kind of a boy band in a way that, like, dudes got cycled in, like, based on how they fit. It wasn't really, like, necessarily an organic deal. It was just like, all right, this guy needs to be here and this guy's out.
Yeah, eventually it does become a business once you hit a certain level. You need the handsome-looking guitar player instead of, like, the guy who's really good but is kind of fugly.
Yeah, you can play on the record. Fuck off. Yeah. Get behind your burlap sack.
I think it was All-American Rejects were kind of the same deal, too. It was, like, two guys who were in a band, and the label said, you are having these two handsome guys in your band as well. Go.
I wish I could get that kind of deal.
Yeah, where do you get in on that, man? Can I get that from, like shit fuck Canadian guy PR? Can he set me up like that? Like, that would be awesome.
I don't know that, you know, this kind of label effect really exists anymore, but I guess theoretically back in the day, if you had some buzz, you could have some guy step in and be like, all right, first off, your face is fucked. You gotta get Botox or whatever. We'll send you to our guy to fix your nose.
Yeah, that was Sugar Ray. Same thing. They were like a hardcore punkish band called the Shrinky Dinks. And that's why Mark McGrath showed up all the time on Headbangers Ball in the 90s, like just kind of hanging out with Lemmy and all these other actual metal bands. He was a part of that scene. And then the label grabbed him and said, okay, you're handsome. We're going to work with that. And switch the band around. Like, now you have a DJ and now you're going to talk about, you know, kissing girls and stuff.
Probably the most famous example of this in the entire universe is the first Beatles drummer was too attractive.
So they got Ringo.
So they got Ringo instead. And there's like this great story about how the guy who was kicked out of the Beatles, obviously, like, went through this great depression for decades, but eventually, like, realized that not being busy with the Beatles got him his family and his little modest life, and he ended up being, like, a lot happier than reportedly a lot of the Beatles ended up. I mean, of course, John Lennon shot in the face, a little different. But I don't know. It's just that's such a strange thing to me, that this guy was too good-looking. The other band members were like, we don't want to look ugly compared to you, so they got fucking Ringo instead.
What's fucking wild to me, Breno, is that, like, I like to imagine that I've been fully immersed in dumbass music trivia all my life, which I have, and I have not heard that story before.
You've not, really?
I haven't, no.
It's a good one. I think I read it in some dumb book somewhere.
Well, good on is Pete Best, right?
Yes.
Let's say it's Pete Best. Good on him for being too attractive. And, you know, you're not Ringo. That's what's important.
He's some hot old Welsh drummer teacher now. You know, it's like you can go get lessons from the first Beatles drummer. Get those 4x4 signatures right on point.
Well, that's kind of fun, just to think about the history of how labels would manipulate artists to kick out the uggos and such, or the two attractos in this case. But I don't know that that's ever going to happen again. I think that we've reached the end of the line with labels having as much influence on the entire life direction of people.
I'd say with pop music, you probably get it a lot more. That's a lot more crafted and workshopped and played out. Since rock music isn't in right now, there's less of a need for it.
I've heard this story about how James Maloney, the frontman from Arsis, like, of all bands, think of fucking, like, technical death metal, super underground, shitty logo looking, shitty album looking Arsis, of all things, and their label guy was all over James Maloney about the fact that he was too fat. And so he developed this, like, horrible eating disorder.
That's right. Wasn't one of their albums or songs called, like, Feed the Devil or,
like,
something like that?
The entire album was based on it. Like, Starve for the Devil. He wrote this fucking album just as a big middle finger to this fucking guy. But it's like, really, man? In death metal, we're going to be doing this shit? This guy's not hot enough to play fucking sweet-picking death metal?
Being fat in metal is hardly a detriment. Like, it's not. Yeah, think about the history of metal dudes who are chunky. It don't matter.
Was this Nuclear Blast?
I have no idea. I wouldn't put it fucking past them. But I also want them to, you know, keep setting us up for interviews when this is all over. So it's probably not them, Jordan.
Snuclear Snast.
It rhymes with Buclear Narast.
God, I want to know what that label guy looked like, too.
I know. He probably looked worse than me. Like, yeah. I can't even imagine.
Just, no, it's the same image you conjured up for a generic metal guy with the stringy goatee, the ball-bearing necklace, the camo shorts. Like, that's who that is.
Receding hairline ponytail.
Oh, yeah, the skullet.
You're like local promoter guy to a T.
Yeah, and he's like, brother, your image is no good. You're too fat.
If you really want to get Arsis off the ground, you know, you can't be a fat fuck. You can't be this pudgy piece of shit. You gotta... And I think the fucking eating disorder that he had was that he would, like, drink himself to a point where he just threw everything up at the end of the day.
Oh, God.
Almost fucking killed himself.
Yeah, and oof, that is brutal, man. Well, I'm glad the Arsis dude is hopefully doing better now. I don't know.
He's looking good. He's looking healthy. He got all his hair shaved off, which is just such a good 30s, 40s move to do. If that metal guy part looks like the fucking Moses scene at the Red Sea, maybe it's fucking time to just get the buzzers on, you know?
I mean, that never stopped Shane Embry from Napalm Death.
No.
It's iconic at this point. Yeah.
It's his look. Like Gene Simmons and being ugly.
Say what you will about Gene Simmons, but despite his ugliness, his lack of character, just being a bad person overall, he fucks a lot. That's what he lives and dies by. We can't take it away from him.
He's come in a lot of mediocre women. I can't fault him for that. Good for him.
Gross.
And when I say that, I mean women with mediocre taste in music, obviously.
Obviously.
I'm not that kind of guy. Come now. I mean, except, unless you're Gene Simmons. Don't come at all anymore, please.
No, stop. Just the world has had enough of your come, Gene Simmons.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have ever had this experience, but have you ever like been listening to an older record and you're like, you know what, I enjoy this older record, I've listened to this a few times throughout the years, it's time to, while I'm listening to this, pull up the Wikipedia page and see what I can learn about it. Do you ever do that?
All the time.
Yeah, I think that's a universal listening experience. Some of our online friends did this thing fairly recently where they took a month to do the ICP challenge, in which they listened to each Insane Clown Posse release. And I'm not at all pissed off that I wasn't invited to do this. I'm laughing, actually, that I wasn't invited to participate in this thing that I would have clearly enjoyed.
Yeah, like, why would you? It's, like, not even that cool, really.
Yeah. So I'm not mad. Never say that I was mad about this, because I'm not.
No.
I'm just quietly whooping in the corner. Of
whoop. Well, I saw like Andrew from Rip to Shreds and our friend Amelia were on the Great Malenko Day. I saw ICP a couple of years ago do the Great Malenko live in concert. It's a fun record, and there's a lot of really fun backstory to it. So I was listening to it. I was having a silly, fun time, and I decided to do that classic move to pull up the Wikipedia page while I was listening to it. And I saw some baffling things. And because there is no news this week, would you guys indulge me in kind of going down a weird rabbit hole of old records and strange reviews and things of the sort?
I think that is a perfect halfway point for the show to evolve to the end of itself. Let's do it, Daddy. What do you got for us?
So there is a review that was published alongside the release of The Great Malenko by, of course, Insane Clown Posse, by Stephen Thomas Erlewine. And it's a fairly brief review. It gives you all the information that you need to know about the story that was happening while this was going on. And then it delves into his personal opinions on this, which I find so utterly baffling that I have to share them with you because it's, you know, it's a monkey on my back. I got to get it off.
let's get you off here, Joe.
Okay. I'll begin the review here. The Insane Clown Posse had a cult following around their hometown of Detroit in the mid-90s, eventually winning a major label contract with Jive. Their deal with Jive was short-lived since Riddlebox bombed on the national market. After all, not many people are interested in overweight, dreadlocked jackasses in clown makeup, spewing naughty lyrics and spraying their audience with cheap soda. I would like to add a little note here that history has vindicated Insane Clown Posse. Still, they have retained a devoted local following, which led to Hollywood Records signing the group in 1996. Hollywood spent $1 million on the recording of ICP's label debut, The Great Malenko, which let the group work with named producers and guest artists like Slash. I will add a note here that Slash did this record for the payment of a couple of bottles of Thunderbird. He just liked doing this, so take that for what you will.
Yeah, for all the shit I've ever talked about Slash, he's just like actually a cool dude historically.
He likes to have fun.
Yeah.
As a result, it was a better record than the predecessors, boasting a tougher sound and some actual hooks without losing the juvenile vulgarity that pleased their following. So everything should have worked out. ICP had a commercial album that could have brought them a big audience if the marketplace could overlook the fact that the duo was dressed like evil clowns. But things didn't work out as planned. On the day of release of The Great Malenko, Hollywood pulled the album from the market, claiming that they were unaware of the offensive content of the record. That seems a little unlikely, since a company wouldn't sink $1 million into a project being unaware of what it was about. Still, the result... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just chuckled because they do that shit all of the time.
The backstory to this, by the way, is that Disney had recently purchased this record label, and there was some kind of like conservative religious boycott over it, so they cut him out immediately.
Yeah, the House of Mouse isn't cool with isn't down with the clown. I understand.
Well, at the time, they were getting a lot of protests because Disney had like Gay Day at Disney World, where like it was a day for LBGQ, I guess it would be at the time, people to like go out and have a good time at the park, and that was unacceptable to, I don't know, the Pat Robertsons of the world.
Florida.
But I digress.
Sure.
Still, the resulting furor meant that the Insane Clown Posse, a group that would never have been famous or infamous, became national figures, and the Great Malenko had some sort of hip status. And although it is better than the rest of ICP's work, it's a little ridiculous to think that its mixture of heavy metal and gangsta satire is hip in the late 90s. And it's even more ridiculous to think that it's worth listening to, even if it has vulgar lyrics. It's the sort of record you wish they would take off the stereo at excruciating frat parties. And thus concludes the review. I would like to say that I have never been to a frat party in 1996, but I have been to frat parties, and I cannot imagine in a million years Insane Clown Posse being ever a choice that would go on the stereo at a frat party.
No. I mean, who are the guys that are parts of fraternities? Like, just picture them in your head.
Yeah.
Greek letters dudes are not fucking the wife beater dreadlock white. Yeah.
I take umbrage with this review because the review mostly, and I'm mad about a review from 1996. Yes, you're correct. This review is mostly just some history of what's going on at the time and a single line review of his opinion on the record, which is that it's the kind of record that would play at a frat party and you wish that they would not play it at a frat party. And this leads me to believe this motherfucker never listened to the goddamn album.
It's like those tweets where people used to say that, this band is just this band for these people. It's just kind of intellectually on that same level. He thinks that by equating the listeners to the music, you as a potential listener will be turned off.
Yeah, that's very astute observation, and I will note incredibly lazy writing.
Yeah.
It's almost like you got to spin a fucking wheel. It's like, all right, Megadeth is spinning another wheel, Slayer for spinning another wheel, Vegans. And it's like, okay, you put together a sentence. There are
those are words,
verbs and nouns.
Perfect. There's perhaps punctuation, you know, not necessary, but
hit tweet on that bitch. You did it.
Yeah, killed him. Got him.
Hundreds of likes. Hundreds of retweets.
Yeah. Oh my God. True. This. You win the internet today.
I am listening to Metallica. Oh my God. You're amazing.
There is a different version of this that's the same thing that I see a lot, but I find utterly baffling, although a little bit amusing. It's like, bisexuals really be wearing clothes. and I don't get it, but a lot of you people seem really fucking amused by it.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense because bisexuals, if you have both options, you should be naked all of the time for all of the sex available to you.
That makes sense.
Maybe that's the joke.
It's the joke. I get it. There's also a spinoff variant of like, if you're an adult that does this incredibly common thing, you were horrifically traumatized as a child. I don't know about that one, but it seems wrong. I don't think that one's accurate.
Motherfuckers really like pepperoni on their pizza, huh?
Canceled.
I think the greatest problem with this review is that he didn't even get into who the Great Malenko is.
He didn't go into any of the concepts of the Joker cards either, which are, you know, a really defining trait of the Insane Clown Posse. He didn't talk about the music in any way either, aside from giving a very general description. But no words for Hocus Pocus.
I mean, a lot of these guys that write these reviews are just like fucking mid-40s jazz flutists that had like a career in some sort of music school or something. They just have some pedigree that is just so far beyond where they should be writing about this stuff.
He was most likely just assigned this and was pissed off. So he wrote all this stuff and then the little one sentence about the actual music.
If you are a baby boomer, you're probably not listening to this show. If you are a baby boomer or a Gen X person, you're probably familiar with a music reviewer by the name of Robert Christgau, who really made a long, long career for himself of spending roughly 10 seconds listening to a record and shitting out a two-line review of it. If you go through his archives, you can see all kinds of wrong, bad opinions. Sonic Youth, I think, put out a song telling him to get fucked after he didn't listen to their debut record and gave it a poor review. But that has been, I guess, the defining trait of people that were published in places like the Rolling Stone for decades. It's just like, all right, you know my name. I am a famous music reviewer because you know my name. So my opinion here is that, I don't know, I was busy smoking weed. I didn't really like this one.
Yeah, I always wonder on a daily basis, usually within the shower, just like, what's Matt Pinfield up to? You know?
I actually know the answer to that.
Jordan, please indulge.
So I actually fell down a little bit of a rabbit hole. Growing up, I had a really great alternative rock station in New Jersey, 106.3, and I just randomly came across a group on Facebook that was just kind of memorializing and remembering the radio station, and a lot of them were actually older generation, so it really wasn't like what I grew up with. It was a lot of like 80s and early 90s, and apparently like Matt Pinfield was one of the DJs on this station, and it was kind of his launching pad to get onto like MTV and like host 120 minutes and do all these other things. But I read recently, there was an article in the group that he had a relapse. He's had substance abuse issues and had a relapse at the beginning of like all of the coronavirus shutdown and stuff like that, because he didn't really have access to treatment and his sponsors and things like that. But friends heard about it and helped him out, and he's doing much better now. So it was kind of like all this information at once, and it's like, oh wow, oh geez, okay, he's all right.
So on drugs but getting off drugs, that's where Matt Pinfield's at.
He's doing better now.
Gang, good goodness for Matt Pinfield.
And hey, just, you know, in terms of other like big name reviewers that old people are familiar with, you guys know Lester Bangs, right?
He's one of the biggest of like any review names that I could possibly think of.
Yeah. I mean, wasn't Almost Famous kind of like a fictionalization of his life at the very beginning?
Yeah, big time.
He also referred to himself as the last white slur. We don't need to get into that. Things are different from decades ago. Problematic at the time, though. there is, of course, his famous review of Black Sabbath's debut record. Do you think Lester Bangs, famous for championing, all kinds of cool bands back in the 70s, do you think it was good?
No.
No, he didn't like it.
Yeah.
Do you want me to get into this real quick?
Let's find out why, Lester didn't like it.
Over across the tracks in the industrial side of Cream Country lie unskilled laborers like Black Sabbath, which was hyped as a rockin' ritual celebration of the satanic mass or some such claptrap, something like England's answer to Coven. Well, they're not that bad, but that's about all the credit you can give them. The whole album is a shuck. Despite the murky song titles and some inane lyrics that sound like Vanilla Fudge playing doggerel tribute to Aleister Crowley, the album has nothing to do with spiritualism, the occult, or anything much except stiff recitations of Cream cliches that sound like the musicians learned them out of a book, grinding on and on with dogged persistence. Vocals are sparse, most of the album being filled with plodding bass lines over which the lead guitar dribbles wooden Claptonisms from the master's tiredest Cream days. They even have discordant jams with bass and guitar reeling like velocitized speed breaks all over each other's musical perimeters, yet never quite finding sync. Just like Cream, but worse. This is insanely brutal.
Yeah. I don't know if I completely disagree with it all.
It's a good representation of a review of its time. Like, nowadays, people don't talk about the band Cream, like, really at all. But you'll still hear people talking about Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
And it's your, like, point of reference. Like, if you're reading a review now and someone might reference, like, Atreyu, for example, like we were talking about earlier, 20 years from now, probably no one's ever going to be doing that. So it's just this, like, frozen in molasses type of review that, when you look back on it, seems kind of ridiculous. But in its time, probably made a lot more sense.
I can envision no scenario in 20 years where an Atreyu reference makes sense at all.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's been 20 years since Atreyu made sense anyway. It's been a while.
It's getting close to it.
Yeah, we're getting to it. I think there's this great story somewhere where Tony Iommi invites some Rolling Stone reviewer to his mansion and proceeds to just fucking beat the ever-living shit out of him for a bad review. I wish I had the story in front of me so I could give you guys better detail, but if you could go look for it, I'm sure it's there. I'm sure it exists.
Well, what's the difference between Connor Clapton and a bag of cocaine? We don't have to answer that. You can just think about it.
Okay.
It is kind of funny to see Clapton as like the man back then, because I don't think Clapton is considered anywhere near the man unless you're a 70-year-old dentist, really. Like, pretty dated, pretty gross, pretty really lame in retrospect. The whole blue-eyed musician guy who also was a big fan of the insane right-wing parties in England.
Getting a little gammony.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, this all reminded me. I've mentioned this on the show before, but, you know, years and years ago, I would read reviews on Pitchfork like every day. That was something I would do when I got to work, was check out the reviews on Pitchfork. I would more than likely never actually listen to the record. I just liked reading these hyper pretentious reviews. and it took me my mind took me back to an older one that it has been intentionally memory holed. Pitchfork stripped it from the site and replaced it with an updated review from a different writer years later. Do you guys remember Andrew W.K.?
No. Yes.
I Get Wet, you know, the one big record that he had, which, you know, a pretty fun record. Has a lot of staying power to this day, I believe. There's a few good tracks on there.
They put a black sticker on the front at Best Buy because the bloody nose was too gross.
Did they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not that explicit.
It wasn't even his blood.
It was Steve Mike's blood.
It was pig blood.
Oh, I did not know this.
He tried to punch himself in the nose to get it going, and it wasn't a lot. So we're like, yeah, just smear him with pig blood. It's fine.
He probably was like, I wish you guys thought of that before I punched myself in the nose.
Seriously. Anyway, Ryan Schreiber wrote this review of I Get Wet when it came out back in the day, and I would like to share it with you in all of its overwrought disdain.
Yes, please.
All right, this is bullshit. I've had it. Is this what we've been reduced to? Michigan metalheads copying ESPN jock jams, capitalizing on the shameful worst of the 1980s and bellowing incessantly about the wondrous virtues of the all-nighter. Rock critics who dissed this entire genre in its heyday, now glorifying its second coming as somehow superior. If this is what the future of music has in store for us, why no apocalypse on New Year's Eve 99? Doesn't God care? Shit, maybe Y2K really was the Armageddon, launching us headfirst into a great black XFC metal abyss, and maybe Andrew W.K. is the first of the four impending horsemen. And that boys and girls, was about all I could muster on March 20th, just as the storm clouds began to crash together for what would soon spin into a torrential whirlwind of one-sheets and NMEs, maybe one of the scariest hypes this planet's ever seen. I was overwhelmed. But now it's July, and almost as quickly as he arrived, Andrew Wilkes Creer has been rudely ushered off the Apollo soundstage and scribbled as a footnote into history's textbook of rock novelties. Been months since I last heard Party Hard on the radio or saw WK thrashing about on M2 like a hyperactive, retarded kid whose parents failed to give him a disciplinary shaking. I just want to go ahead and focus on that sentence real quick.
And we're back.
You huge asshole.
That was just the fucking internet at the time, man. We would just say that shit.
Yeah, that's true. This insanely moralizing scolding about the sound of this record, followed by like shaking an abuse, like shaking a developmentally disabled child to get it to work right. Like,
yeah.
Fuck you.
Like, oh, that's why the kid is like that. That's why the kid is screaming at the grocery store, because the parents just didn't fucking grab him and snap his head back and forth.
But by all means, go ahead and tell me about how this record is beneath you.
Yeah.
If it hadn't been for this meddling CDR I was sent by Island Records promotion team, I might have already forgotten the guy. Ah, yes, in due time. I take immense comfort in the realization that at some distant point in the future, I won't be really to recall any of I Get Wet. And whether that'll be due to its legitimate forgettability or a future struggle with Alzheimer's, I don't much care, so long as I never again have to envision his mangy Raw Is War hair swath or listen to these unshakable Cro-Magnon shoutathons. And so this is where I get to say that, as evidenced in the italics above, I almost told you so. A few weeks prior to my first attempt at taking down this sorry sack, my old pal Brett Discrenzio, who is a culture addict, spends a fair bit of his spare time scouring the British music rags, had rung by to write up the Promise Rings' Wood Water. He'd read about I Get Wet in Mojo or something and saw it amongst the promo stacks on my windowsill. Have you heard this? Now, Brent, I like to hook up and get cynical from time to time. We'll even bash the bands we're into just for shits. So I was patiently waiting for D to reel one off so I could start in, casting to the wind the fact that I, in fact, hadn't yet heard it. It's pretty funny. It's basically these huge guitar riffs, sort of soccer anthems. He quickly unloaded Von Bolin from his disc changer and toss in the CDR. Instantly blaring multi-track guitars and shouting range stadium drums came accosting. I tried to yell something, but my exclamation was swallowed by the immense wind tunnel attack of the clench fist maelstrom. What? First of all, I would like to say that maelstrom has never been used in real life, aside from in shitty music reviews. Have you seen it used in any other way?
Maelstrom. What is a maelstrom? Just like a strong storm?
Storm. Yeah, it's a word that you use when you're a music reviewer, and you have 10 words that you can use.
Yeah, like punishing, maelstrom, riffs.
Brutal.
Chugging.
Slamming.
Do we do pounding already?
Pounding, that's a good one. Primal.
Slab.
Slab, there we go. I was hopeless. Nothing could penetrate a sound that dense. I was overcome. I tried to remember the last time anyone dared to push rock so poppily over the top and figured it must have been sometime around Hysteria. I sat rapt by the simple barbarity of that sound, Andrew barking adamantly over the exploding plastic fury. The gall! WK demanded respect whether he deserved it or not. His conviction was startling, and the sound so scrutinously polished it lapped itself back into rawness. And indeed, it was time to party. The party, as it just so happened, lasted all of 3 minutes, appropriately about the same lifespan as a pinch of big league chew. For this was bubble gum in its purest, stickiest form, designed for the sole purpose of imminent pop, to be packaged, marketed, and shipped by a grand corporation, and to be enjoyed by the consumer for a few moments before being spit or swallowed. I spat, and with the poisonous substance expelled from my system, I saw it for what it was. I Get Wet is an insidious beast planting itself into the deepest instinctual recesses of your brainstem, where it instantly detonates in a visceral adrenal charge. There is suddenly no respect for proper behavior, just the urge to turn acrobatic flips and smash everything within a 50-foot radius. You're Genghis Khan in the San Dimas Sports Mart, somersaulting over Nike racks to the slippery when wet synth metal of Beethoven's Schmidt music foray into Bachman-Turner Overdrive. And then you wake up the next morning, hazy-headed and groggy, humiliated by preceding night's incidents. Don't blame yourself. This music is evil in its purest form, wafting through air, waiting to possess every decent person in the entire room until they're flat on their backs in bed, wrists tied to the headboard, with drunken priests standing holy at their sides to exorcise the demon. And the demon is a tricky son of a bitch, spinning at you in circles of confusion and chanting at the life-affirming message to brainwash you into truly believing right to the core of your soul that what it speaks is the good truth. Read any review with WK, in which he spews naive positivity like dad's warbly old self-help cassettes. There is no irony about Andrew. He is, in fact, so earnest it sends any straight-thinking individual into epileptic fits of shivers and winces. For Christ's sake, the man opens the second paragraph of his self-writ bio with, "I will work every day to feel okay," before finally getting around to calling the music perfect, because all it wants is for people to be happy. Lies! This is so insanely hyperbolic that it borders on the satanic bullshit that we were talking about at the beginning of the episode.
I think Fred Durst, I really felt for him in the fact that he was like, well, you know, I wanted to speak to the victims, I didn't want to speak to the bullies, but this guy, he's speaking to my bully. I just want to go out there and shove him in a locker. I want to give him swirlies. I want to pants him on a playground. I want to give him a wedgie on the flagpole and just spin him up where his just balls will be forever damaged. I want to bully this man so hard. I never wanted to just push someone into the sandbox as hard as this guy makes you want to do it.
This is really indicative of a certain style of criticism that was in vogue for maybe about 10 years there in the 2000s, where you were not allowed to like anything that was in any way accessible, and you had to put yourself above the listener. If you enjoy this, you are in fact stupid, and I know more than you.
Right, and the way that I present that is through the poetry of my, you know, symbolism in writing and metaphorical speaking.
Now, we kind of went back across the way and embraced pop maybe a little bit too hard. So there will be a backlash to that hopefully coming soon, because I see way too many dipshits on Twitter. They're like, y'all need to give Dave Matthews Band the respect it deserves. It's like, no, I don't.
Satellite really slaps.
This new Deftones is great.
Yeah. Okay.
I said it. All right. You got your Adidas track jackets in your closet somewhere, boys. I know what's going on.
But this was very much a style where the reviewer was taking a place of being not just smarter, but more morally perfect than the listener. You're able to describe how this music is for, and I will quote, retarded people. This is what he says again in the review later on.
There's more.
He goes on for another fucking 7 paragraphs, Bruno.
Why?
Is this like Charles Dickens and he was paid by the letter?
Actually, that would make a lot of sense. That in the early days of online publishing, that probably could have been the case.
What's the actual time frame of this being published? Was it like right when the album was made, or?
So, I Get Wet came out in 2001.
Right, very early.
This review was published in 2002. So he was still extremely mad about it.
Well, it took him a fucking year to write it, clearly.
there's so much bitterness in this review that it makes me wonder if there were some other things going on in this reviewer's life that kind of bled into his work.
Just Andrew WK fucked his girlfriend is really like what it is.
I was going to say not enough, clearly.
But yeah, like I've seen, I've probably seen Andrew WK, I don't know, a lot of times. He plays Austin a lot. He plays super tiny shows. It's different every single time. It's really pretty impressive stuff for being, you know, pretty on the nose, stupid music. People have a good time, and I enjoyed seeing all of those performances. So I find the whole thing so, again, overwrought that, like you said, there has to be something else happening here. It's benign.
So while you were reading the review, I did the thing we talked about and looked up the album on Wikipedia. Do you know who played drums on this album?
No.
Donald Tardy of Obituary.
No way!
Yeah.
Those are hard-hitting drums. And I find this very interesting.
All I know is I fucking loved Party Hard in 2001. I didn't give a shit. What was I? Probably 14.
I was, I'm trying to, like, I remember that the guy that sat next to me in science class gave me a burned version of this CD and told me how this guy was sick and he would, like, hit himself in the face with bricks and stuff because he was crazy. And then he tried to tell me that he grew weed, and I became suspicious that my lab partner in seventh grade science class knew how to grow weed.
Right. Yeah, it's well, first of all, the kids that could burn a CD back then, they were fucking tech wizards. They were like these kids that had the know-how to do something that was just so beyond our capabilities as young teenagers. It's like those guys that were able to record live television onto a blank VHS. It's just mind-numbing stuff. And, yeah, everybody had that friend. He told you that, oh, this guy hits himself with bricks and, you know, removes two ribs so he can suck his own dick.
Yeah. Every in those early internet days, if you were in junior high or such, you heard some crazy rumors about, otherwise totally benign people. The Marilyn Manson stuff, the rumors around him were inaccurate, though there was reason to be suspicious. apparently that guy's a big, huge, fucking abusive rapist freak. But that's a story for another episode. It wasn't him removing his own ribs so he could suck his dick. It was him abusing women.
Really? Being some creep with millions of dollars.
Just... Yeah, huge, huge creep. But he'll probably die soon, so that's good.
Yeah, well, that's good.
I don't know, man. I kind of lost my train of thought here just because I'm out of air from reading this huge fucking review. I have more. I don't really want to get into them. I'm too tired for that. Instead, I just want to ask you guys, do you recall anything like an album that you liked that you went through and you read about it and you were like, this is not okay. This, as a person enjoying this art, this is wrong.
Well, I don't know why, but YouTube constantly throws Anthony Fantano at me, just regularly. I go on there and I listen to music and I go around and look at music. So YouTube's like, oh, Anthony Fantano, he's up to speed on you, man. Here it is. And it's like, of course, if I go and listen to some kind of album and some kind of music, there's going to be a video linking to what he thinks about it. And despite the fact that that is just a bloody, leaky mosquito bite that should be left alone until it's totally healed, I just have to go scratch the fucking itch, Jordan. You know what I mean? It's just, I gotta do it. I gotta see what this asshole has to say about any given album. So, he's pretty shitty about a lot of albums that I liked. Specifically, that latest Mastodon one, Emperor of Sand. He was fucking ludicrously angry about it. I thought that was a good album. He really hated the most recent Baroness record, which I know had its faults, but he was just, it was like a 4 out of 10 he gave it. He just dug into how much he hated that record. So sure, I mean, it exists these days. You just have it in a different format.
That's the thing, man. I can't be bothered to watch somebody that I know I'm going to disagree with. Like, I want to read it so I can get through the whole thing in, you know, 10, you know, 1/10 of the time. I don't know if you guys do this too, but every time I watch an older movie, like the first thing I want to do is check and see like what Roger Ebert had to say about it.
What are some movies that Roger Ebert really hated?
Well, I mean, that's the thing about Ebert, though, is like even if I disagreed with his review, it was really interesting to read his thoughts because he wasn't pretentious. So, like, I love like David Lynch's catalog, and he hated most of Lynch's work until it got to Mulholland Drive, and he's like, finally, David Lynch has delivered on the promise of, you know, what he was doing in the early ones, and it all came together for me here. And I'm like, yes, I feel you, Ebert.
Thanks, EB. Jordan, what do you think
about
everything? Yeah, we have just screamed you into silence on this episode.
Yeah, do you care about reviews at all? Is that a thing that you like to check out?
I avoid. At least with music, I avoid music reviews like at all costs. It's if I'm gonna like something, I'm gonna like something. One person's thoughts or opinions aren't gonna change it. The only thing I'd be interested in is like facts or things I need to know about it. Like, this person's a scumbag, or this person was in this band full of scumbags. You shouldn't listen to them. Okay, that's useful information, but you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't make a difference if the guitars are shredding or the drum is a machine gun blast. I'll listen to it on my own. I have access to the internet.
So you would say you're more of a facts over feelings kind of guy then?
Sure. No, it's just I don't feel the need to read reviews, even though like I do write some for the website. Most of mine essentially boil down to, this is good, you should listen to it. Whereas, you know, some people just bash bands, and it's just like, well, I don't get anything out of this. Because even if something isn't good, I could still get enjoyment out of it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, we enjoy professional wrestling. It is not good. It is not high-profile entertainment, but you could still enjoy it.
Sure. Then that makes sense. I think my predilection towards this is just, you know, I being addicted to reading shit on the internet for most of my life. If you are a huge music nerd like me, and you like reading about reviews, you know, even though that doesn't matter at all, I would highly encourage folks to check out Mark Prendel's archive, in which he would go through and review the entire discography of bands. Like, he reviewed every Kiss record. He reviewed every Andrew Dice Clay album, like just complete and total thoughts around everything that somebody that isn't worth a damn like put out. It's a really enjoyable thing, and I love that kind of completist nonsense.
I need the intricate knowledge of Hickory Dickory Dock Andrew Dice Clay jokes.
Exactly. If you have that kind of brain worm problem like I do, like, you got to do it. It was formative for me as a whatever I am now.
So and, we're over an hour at this point.
Oh.
I just wanted to like, just these kind of reviews are really just personal attacks on people, and one thing I see often is that like critics will hide behind this guise of just the validity of criticism. That's something that they will write paragraphs and paragraphs about as well. But if you're going to get online, you're going to write this much. Like, Andrew WK deserves to give you like a bloodier nose than he ever had on any given album.
I have to wonder, like, that, you know, I Get Wet was a huge success. I mean, he still tours behind that one record to this day. I don't think he lost much sleep over this one.
Yeah,
I think it's just raging against the dying light, if I can use some overwrought bullshit too. the proliferation of the internet and blogs like ours have made criticism totally unnecessary. Yeah. And that's probably for the best. But it's fun to get into sometimes, especially when there's nothing going on in the world of music. Those are my thoughts.
It's like open Spotify or don't. Like, what do you need to read the fucking review for?
I need to know if somebody else liked it. That's really what it is. Like, I love this. I want to know if people feel the same connection to this as I do.
You want confirmation bias.
Or
just as if you hated something, you want someone else to hate it with you.
Absolutely. Or I want to know if somebody out there is wrong. I want to know, like, if you took the hours to write the review of a thing that I think is beautiful, and just to say totally, wholly, factually incorrect things about it.
Well, what about the third option? Have you guys ever had this happen where you really did just organically enjoy something, and then you read a review about it, and the review hit on some valid points and changed your mind?
Not once.
I think, like I said, if there's some sort of factoid I didn't know, like, you watch a movie and you're like, oh, this isn't bad. And then you see, I don't know, Max Landis directed it or wrote it. And then you go, oh, well, this movie sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
You're not separating art from artist, Jordan.
To tie a bow on this episode, I will say one thing that reviewers should never do is totally obliterate a band in a review, shit on them horribly, and then tag them in social media. My band once got like a 3 out of 10 review, and then the whatever shit blog WordPress thing tagged us in it. And it was just like, what am I supposed to do with this? Thank you for letting me know you didn't like something.
Do you want me to share this now?
Yeah. I was kind of hoping for like a DM, like, hey, would you guys mind sharing this? It's like, yes. Yes, I would mind sharing it.
Hey, everybody. Just wanted to let you know that upthegauntlets.wordpress.com thought that we suck.
So check us out. Because who wants to be like this clown? Boys, we got to go. I love y'all. Deftones are great. I was just kidding. Everybody stay safe, stay metal. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Yeah.
You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.